Fundamentally, nuclear fusion is what you get when you slam atoms together and generate some kind of energetic byproduct from the reaction of that atomic melding. And nuclear fission is what happens when you split an atom into smaller component parts. Fission also generates energetic byproducts, and it's possible, under some circumstances, to create a chain reaction of atom splitting after sparking an initial nuclear reaction, which basically means creating one atom splitting reaction, which then causes another and another, and each new reaction triggers yet more reactions, which keeps the whole process going for potentially quite a long time. There's value in sparking a relatively short-lived fission reaction, but that value is mostly destructive in nature. Atomic bombs are able to create massive explosions from a relatively small amount of mass because they create these sorts of chain reactions, atoms breaking apart and causing more and more atoms to break apart in that way. And the energy derived from that atom breaking leads to the destruction that is the point of these weapons. It's also possible to blend fusion reactions with fission reactions within such weapons, using the atom breaking of fission to trigger fusion reactions, the combining of hydrogen isotopes like deuterium and tritium, which in turn can cause more fission reactions, increasing the power and range of the resulting blast. This type of weapon is usually called a thermonuclear weapon and tends to be many times as destructive as a mere nuclear, sometimes called atomic, bomb. Controlling these reactions for longer periods has been a more valuable undertaking for most nations, though, in part because of, thankfully, well-deployed and, thus far at least, mostly adhered to nuclear arms treaties and controls, but also because the benefits of nuclear power are many and immense, and go far further than the value of even a very powerful weapon. All functional nuclear power plants that exist today are predicated on nuclear fission, the breaking apart of atoms. And in general, these are complex systems and technologies built and maintained to achieve a bogglingly simple outcome. They turn turbines. And more specifically, they turn turbines by generating steam. In essence, then, we split atoms. We maintain reactions that allow such atom splitting to happen over and over and over again, sustaining and making these chain reactions safe in a super-moderated, well-contained environment with a huge number of fail-safes and precautions and regulations. But ultimately, the point of these power plants is to generate heat from those atom-splitting reactions and to use that heat to boil water, which generates steam, which spins turbines to generate electricity. The same concept also powers propellers or generators on ships and nuclear submarines, but it's the same general theory, whatever you end up using that heat for. Much of the complexity within these sorts of power-generating or ship-pushing systems is related to keeping everything safe and preventing uncontrolled chain reactions, which could lead to a meltdown and the generation of gobs of radioactive materials that aren't controlled or disposed of in relatively safe ways. Though relatively safe is a debatable term here, as fission-based nuclear power does result in such waste even when everything's working perfectly. And typically, that waste has to be stored safely for somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 years, which is no small or cheap feat. But the majority of resources plowed into this method of power generation is related to safety and waste disposal and similar precautionary measures. The reason we keep using this type of power, despite that nuclear waste generating downside and the potential for some kind of meltdown if a relatively small potential these days, and despite the amount of land and resources required to house such power plants and to do it safely, and despite the concerns that many people have, warranted and unwarranted, about the potential of a Chernobyl or Fukushima-like meltdown occurring at some point, making the surrounding area unlivable for a long time because of uncontrolled energy release and/or radioactive materials in the environment, is that this type of steady, consistent, predictable power is difficult to come by via any other means. Most renewable sources of energy are either natural resource dependent. You need to have a river with a steady level of water to build a dam for hydropower, and you need to have regular strong winds to build wind turbines, or unreliable in their power generation. Solar panels are great and relatively inexpensive to deploy these days, but even sunny places that are ideal for this type of power generation cannot produce solar power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because of nighttime and because of clouds and because of all sorts of ebbs and flows in the atmosphere. Most non-renewable sources of energy require that we burn finite resources extracted from the ground. So oil and coal-based power plants, which are the most common type of power plant globally, require supply chains that bring these finite fossil fuel-based resources to a central location where they can be burned, the energy they contain extracted, and that creates pollutants, churns greenhouse gases into the environment, and can also succumb to the vicissitudes of global trade, resource extraction, and diplomacy, among countless other variables. As I record this, there's a natural gas shortage throughout Europe, caused in part by weather conditions, in part by a diplomatic conflict with Russia, which provides around 40% of Europe's natural gas, which they use for heating and manufacturing purposes, and due in part to pandemic-related weirdness in the energy market. So while this type of energy generation is great in some ways, it's often more consistent and reliable than renewable methods, as it's less dependent on how the wind is blowing on a particular day and whether or not it's cloudy. These sources are horrible in other ways because of that potential to tweak the climate over time, because of all the additional pollutants they create, and because they're also not perfect in terms of supply and demand, and can thus go offline or become very expensive, particularly at times when they are most needed. Nuclear fission-based power plants, then, while also far from perfect, are relatively stable compared to other common methods of power generation, and are thus, despite having gone through several decades of unpopularity, even to the point where many nations have removed or are removing quite a few of their already built nuclear power plants over the past 3 decades and continuing today. Despite all that, they still look pretty good compared to some of the other options we've got on the table, even with the many downsides they introduce into the power equation. What I'd like to talk about today is nuclear fusion-based power, what it could add to the mix, and why it's back in the news after a long, optimistic but generally unproductive, in terms of practical outcomes, decades-long developmental period. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. Let's Know Things is an independent, listener-supported show. If you're finding some value in what I'm doing here, consider becoming a supporter. One of the simplest ways to do that is to become a patron at patreon.com/letsknowthings. You can also become a member at understandery.com. But you can find a complete list of both monetary and non-monetary ways to support this show at letsknowthings.com/support. A great big thanks to everybody who's already helping to support this show, and thank you in advance if you're considering doing so in the future. All right, let's get back to the show. Thank you. The article I'd like to start with today comes from BBC News, and it's entitled, U.S. Lab Takes Further Step Towards Nuclear Fusion Goal. As I mentioned in the intro, all nuclear power we have today, as of early 2022, is derived from nuclear fission reactions. We've been building fully functional nuclear power plants using fission since the mid-1950s, beginning with the Obninsk nuclear power plant in the Soviet Union, but then really kicking things off with the Calder Hall power plant in the United Kingdom a few years later in 1956. That was the first full-scale nuclear power plant, dedicated entirely to generating electricity while also producing extra plutonium on the side. And while there were other power plants built elsewhere in earlier years, including the Experimental Breeder Reactor 1, which was built in the U.S. in 1951 and was the first reactor to use its heat to generate electricity, in that specific case, producing enough power to light 4 light bulbs. This later generation of power plant became the default approach taken in subsequent years, and fortunately allowed for the production of vastly more power, way beyond what's necessary to light a handful of bulbs. As of late 2021, there were 440 nuclear reactors in operation globally, collectively producing a little more than 10% of all electricity generated. The U.S. houses the majority of these power plants, with 93 in operation, with France coming in second with 56, China in third with 51, Russia up next with 38, followed by Japan with 33. There are also operational nuclear power plants in South Korea, India, Canada, the UK, Ukraine, Sweden, Spain, Belgium, Germany, Czech Republic, Pakistan, Finland, Switzerland, Hungary, Slovakia, Argentina, South Africa, Mexico, Bulgaria, Romania, Brazil, Slovenia, the Netherlands, Armenia, and Iran. And that's the order of most to least power plants, after those top 5 nuclear power users, with South Korea up near the top with 24 such plants, and Iran down near the bottom, alongside Armenia and the Netherlands and Slovenia, each of which has 1 such power plant in operation as of October 2021. As I mentioned, nuclear power provides a bit more than 10% of all electricity generated on the planet today, but it provides about 28% of low or zero carbon energy, second only to hydropower, which is by far the largest source of clean energy right now. There are 55 new nuclear power plants planned globally as of January 2022, with some fairly substantial new facilities in the works in Russia, but the vast majority of them planned for Asia, especially China, though India and the United Arab Emirates are also seemingly pretty ambitious about this method of power generation at the moment. Part of the impetus behind this wave of new nuclear power buildouts, after a period of relative quiet in this space, is the greenhouse gas emission commitments made by these governments and by the companies within their borders. Many governments are funding the construction of new hydro, solar, and wind power infrastructure, but you can only build so many of these sorts of things at a time, currently, because of the limited materials available to build them, and because such technologies are limited to places where the sun shines just right, where the wind blows appropriately, and so on. There's a relative shortage of building capacity then, but also a natural cap of what each method can generate in terms of power in a given region. So while at times the vast expanses of wind turbines around the UK produce most or all of the electricity used by residents and manufacturers in the country, at other times they can only generate a fraction of what's needed. Thus, although nuclear fission-based power plants come with their own downsides, including the production of very long-lasting nuclear waste that has to be stored in special, expensive ways, and the negative public sentiment due in part to this type of power's very nature, but amplified by memories of meltdowns like Chernobyl and the more recent Fukushima incident in Japan, Despite those downsides, nuclear power provides what some consider to be an essential zero-carbon substitution for the coal and gas-fired power plants that are slowly being phased out. For a long while, though, there's been a dream within the scientific community to generate power from nuclear fusion instead of nuclear fission. And remember, the former involves slamming atoms together, fusing them, and the latter, which is what we currently use for power, involves breaking atoms apart. In both cases, you can create energetic byproducts, heat, most usefully for these purposes, but so far we've only been able to create triggerable, sustainable reactions using fission. Sustainable fusion-based power is theoretically possible. It's actually what stars like our sun use to generate their power. But it's not something we've been able to rely upon because we haven't been able to figure out how to get more power out than we put in. This is because it's currently quite energetically expensive to get a fusion reaction going and to sustain that reaction. It requires a whole lot of control over the temperature and pressure variables, which in turn could allow for the perpetuation of the reaction and the long-term generation of excess energy, but not the way that we currently control those things. At the moment, we spend a whole lot of energy controlling those factors to the point where, to use totally made-up energy metrics for explanatory purposes, we might spend 2 units of energy to make this reaction work, but only get 1 unit of energy back as heat produced by the reaction, which we can then convert into electricity if we choose. So we lose some of our investment during this process rather than gaining from it. And that's more or less been the case since we started exploring this concept in earnest back in the mid-20th century, around the same time we were investing in early nuclear fission power plants and research facilities. We understood enough about how fusion worked to blend it with fission in developing thermonuclear weapons, but not enough to figure out how to spark and sustain fusion reactions in the same practical and safe way that we can spark and sustain fission reactions. The past several decades have seen a varied and interesting array of possible solutions to this problem of nuclear fusion being too energetically expensive to serve as a practical power source. One approach makes use of what's called a tokamak, which is a machine that uses a torus, a donut-shaped space, in combination with a powerful magnetic field to confine plasma, which is a fundamental state of matter, like a liquid or a solid, but which in this case is the substance in which the desired sustained fusion reactions occur. Other containment shapes are also being experimented with, but magnetic fields are popular mechanisms for forcing the plasma into whichever shape is being used, and it's considered by many to be a likely means of eventually achieving net power production, getting more power out than you put in, despite the generation of this magnetic field itself being quite a power-hungry undertaking. We've also seen different permutations of laser-based solutions, which typically involve compressing and heating fuel pellets made out of tritium and deuterium, which are then hit with high-powered lasers, which in some cases can then start up fusion reactions inside this fuel. The National Ignition Facility, or NIF, in the U.S. is the largest operation making use of this type of fusion setup, which is often called inertial confinement fusion, and they actually managed to hit 70% efficiency back in August of 2021, which is a pretty big deal, as that means the reaction they sustained produced 70% of the energy that was spent making and containing it, which is up from many years' worth of experiments in which only about 3% of the energy spent was generated in the resultant reaction. So while this isn't the only approach that's led to double-digit energy efficiency in recent years, such achievements are still new, and this one has taken the lead in terms of overall efficiency thus far. The NIF is also the lab mentioned in that BBC piece. That story is about another recent milestone that was described in a pair of papers published by the team at the NIF that, as with their other efforts, used a powerful laser to energize fuel contained within a capsule about the size of a peppercorn. This process, using this type of capsule, compresses the fuel to 100 times the density of lead and heats it up to about 100 million degrees Celsius, which is about 180 million degrees Fahrenheit, and that generates plasma in which fusion can take place. The milestone written about in these papers and reported upon in this article is related to what happened inside the plasma post laser strikes in a recent experiment by this lab. The fusion taking place inside this plasma became the dominant source of heat within the containment space, and that allowed it to trigger more fusion reactions by itself, going into what's called a burning plasma state. This is a desirable, until now only theorized, state to reach because it means you can invest less energy to keep such a reaction going after you've gotten it to a certain point within a certain containment space, because it's continuing to heat itself without additional energy invested by you. This also would seem to open a door toward greater gains in efficiency in the future, as it's now practically possible to ignite the plasma so it generates more fusion energy, making the entire process less energy expensive, and as a consequence, potentially, more energy sustainable. So that's a feather in the cap of inertial confinement fusion approaches to solving this problem. They've been chalking up a lot of milestones in a relatively short period, just the last couple of years. One of the more promising near-future projects being built in this space right now, though, is called the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, which is a magnetic confinement reactor that will use the largest tokamak confinement space ever built for such a purpose, with 10 times the plasma volume of any existing tokamak. The ITER is being built next to a large energy research facility in southern France and is scheduled to be completed in 2025, with its first plasma scheduled for December the same year. And the goal of the ITER is to produce 10 times the thermal output as is used to produce the fusion reaction. So they're aiming big here, as that's compared to today's record-breaking 70% efficiency, which is 7/10 output, compared to making 10 times as much energy as is spent. So for comparison, that's like investing a dollar and getting 70 cents back today, and they are looking to invest a dollar and to receive $10 in return. The ITER is funded and operated by China, the EU, India, Japan, Russia, South Korea, and the United States as a joint research venture, though quite a few other countries are also involved indirectly, including the UK, Switzerland, Australia, Canada, Kazakhstan, and Thailand. Construction on the complex in which this reactor is housed began in 2013, and construction on the tokamak began in 2020, and the overall price, initially estimated to be something like 6 billion euros, is now projected to be in the neighborhood of 18 to 22 billion euros. And it's worth noting that scientific endeavors of this kind often see inflated price tags. Beyond the potential scientific benefits of this reactor, it's also perceived by many to be a testament to the human spirit and the potential for international collaboration, as it could help us solve species-wide problems and is being funded by such a wide variety of, at times quite oppositional, even antagonistic, governmental entities, and will be operated by a huge group of brilliant people from around the world. There's something poetic about the idea that we might, as a species, harness the same power used by the sun to create plenty where currently there is scarcity, and to do so collectively, rather than having just one nation or group of people claim the innovation for themselves. An offshoot, or maybe a descendant of ITER, even though it hasn't been fully built or run yet, is what's called the DEMO, or Demonstration Power Plant, predicated on the idea that scaling down the principles and hardware used in the ITER should be feasible, and it may even be possible to leapfrog the production of the research-focused ITER using what's already been learned to make an early version of energy-positive, scale-model electricity-producing fusion reactors. In other words, there's a parallel project being pursued by many of the same entities involved in the ITER project, and these are conceptual schematics for what will hopefully be replicable, mass production capable, small electricity producing power plants that, if everything goes according to plan, would be capable of producing a gross thermal output of 2,000 megawatts with a thermal input of 80 megawatts. So quite the net gain, and that would add up to something like 25 times the energetic output for the input invested. So very, very efficient compared to what we've got today. This is still speculative, but there are efforts underway to have a prototype version of this concept actually built and operating by 2051. Based on designs that are meant to be finished up before 2030, engineering issues that are scheduled to be figured out before 2040, and construction that's meant to begin between 2040 and 2050. In practice, this may mean very little, as this is an effort that's kind of sort of organized by a central body with a lot of government players involved, but it's not a unified, group-funded project. It's a collection of blueprints and schematics and shared knowledge, all of which is based on stuff that we don't know for sure will work. But if it does, it's meant to ensure we're ready to produce what amounts to unlimited free energy around the world as quickly as possible, beginning mid-century, 2051. And this is being undertaken now because it's possible we could finish up the ITER, discover that it works, but then have to wait a very long time to figure out how to put those findings into productive electricity-generating practice in a way that will scale. This demo effort is meant to front-load the majority of those scaling issues, so we're ready to go with the energy making globally, rapidly installing many of these little reactors in a short period of time, if all goes according to plan. Because that would basically allow us to solve all our energy problems for all time and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels to essentially zero pretty rapidly without much fuss. Now, there are quite a few other approaches being experimented with right now, and there's a chance that one of them will end up taking the lead in the race for fusion energy efficiency after some new approach is taken or some new technology integrated into the process. There's also a chance, not a likely one based on what we know now, but there is a chance that fusion will be a dead end. It just won't pan out, or it won't work with our existing technology, and we'll have to wait a few generations before it works, in which case we may need to rely upon newer, safer versions of fission power plants that have already been developed and in some cases deployed instead of these they-just-might-work anticipated fusion plants. Again, the main reason nuclear power is so valuable as part of our larger energy mix is that it keeps going all the time and is not reliant on the same ebbs and flows in weather and day-night cycles or even supply chain issues. It's got its own downsides, but they are distinct from those found in other energy production setups, and that makes them useful for filling in the gaps left by these other options. We may see new battery technologies that render some of these gaps less threatening and pressing to address. If we can store more energy less expensively from our solar panels and wind turbines when we've got excess being generated, and we can use that energy stored within giant or small but multitudinous batteries when it's nighttime or the wind isn't blowing, that would go a long way toward making nuclear power less necessary, at least in some cases. Likewise, there's a chance that we'll see innovations in other technologies like hydrogen, which works like a battery, and that you have to use energy to make the hydrogen. But once it's made, you can then burn it like a fossil fuel without the greenhouse gas emissions. And if we create hydrogen using green energy, that makes this fuel type functionally like a battery, and that in turn could lessen our dependency on nuclear power. In the meantime, though, nuclear power remains a fairly vital component of our global energy mix. And though some countries are considering phasing them out, it'll likely be a while before that phasing out becomes thinkable in many of the world's major economies that currently rely on such power. If you're enjoying Let's Know Things, consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/letsknowthings. You can also support this show and all of my work by becoming a member at understandery.com. Folks who become paid supporters get an additional episode of the show each month, but also, importantly, make all these free episodes possible. A great big thanks to everybody who's already helping to support this show, and thank you in advance if you're considering doing so in the future. The book I'd like to recommend today is called Immune, A Journey into the Mysterious System That Keeps You Alive by Philip Detmer. There's a pretty good chance that if you've ever watched a science video on YouTube, you already know this author's work, even if you've never heard his name before. He's the guy behind the popular Kurzgesagt illustrated science videos, which are just charming and delightful, but also importantly quite informative. And this book has a similar tone in that it's somewhat funny at times, but it also makes the complex topic of our immune systems fairly intuitive and comprehensible without dumbing anything down. It gives good examples, good metaphors, and provides a large amount of information in a very digestible package. Now, if any of that sounds interesting to you, consider picking up a copy of Immune by Philip Detmer. You can find out more about me and my work at colin.io. You can find the show notes and transcript for this episode and every episode of the podcast at letsknowthings.com. And you can find a portfolio of all my projects, podcasts, writings, and otherwise at understandery.com. Feel free to reach out and say howdy on social media. I'm Colin Wright on Facebook, and at Colin is my name on most of the other ones. Thank you so very much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.